Africa. It's Thursday, February 25th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, COVAX delivers its first vaccines to Ghana.
The COVAX initiative aims for equitable vaccine access for developing nations.
Also ahead, the UN calls for an investigation into reports of human rights abuses by Eritrean troops in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
Such allegations need to be investigated promptly and thoroughly by independent mechanisms.
Plus, a Kenyan company turns locusts into animal feed. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Ghana, which has become the first country in the world to receive COVID-19 vaccines under the COVAX initiative. COVAX is an international program designed to deliver COVID-19 vaccines to cash-poor countries. Kent Mensah reports from Accra.
The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, on Wednesday morning delivered 600,000 doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine to Ghana. The vaccines were sent by COVAX. The COVAX initiative aims for equitable vaccine access for developing nations. It is led by the World Health Organization, WHO, the Gavi Vaccine Alliance, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, CEPI. A Ghana government delegation and officials from UNICEF and the WHO received the vaccines at the airport. The Director General of Ghana's Health Service, Dr. Patrick Kuma Abuaji, tells the public that the vaccines are safe.
We can see that there have been so many millions of people in the world have been vaccinated, and nobody has reported any severe adverse reaction. And so people should take their hope in that and so that this is a very safe and effective strategy that has been being applied.
The AstraZeneca vaccine was made by the Serum Institute of India. South Africa halted its rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine earlier this month after a study showed it was less effective than hoped for against variants of the coronavirus. The WHO, however, recommended using it even in countries where the variant strains are circulating, saying it appears to prevent severe cases and can still save lives. The Director of Health Promotion at the Ghana Health Service, Dr. Abuaji Da Costa, says they will increase education about the vaccines.
We have actually started the education. I was just going to say that there is more to be done in the coming weeks.
A statement from Ghana's Information Ministry says President Nana Akufo-Addo will be among the first to receive a shot when inoculations begin on March 2nd. The statement said vaccines will be given to health workers, persons above 60 years of age or with underlying health conditions and other essential workers. Ghana is the first of 92 lower-income countries that will receive vaccines for free through COVAX. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra.
European leaders will talk vaccines, borders, and COVID passports during a two-day video summit starting Thursday that will address security and defense issues. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports the talks are shadowed by growing criticism of the EU's slow coronavirus vaccine rollout.
Critics of the European Union's COVID vaccine strategy got new ammunition this week. A new German study suggests that while the United States and ex-EU member Britain may achieve herd immunity by year's end, thanks to their relatively rapid vaccine rollouts, key EU countries like France, Germany, and Italy will have to triple their daily vaccinations to get there. The dissent has come within EU ranks, starting with Hungary's leader, Viktor Orban, who has turned instead to Russian and now Chinese vaccines as alternatives. All this is backdropping the EU's two-day virtual summit. Brussels-based analyst Camino Montero Martinez from the Center for European Reform think tank says leaders attending it also face mounting backlash at home.
I think that's going to hit citizens quite sharply. Spring and the summer rolls over and they realize they will spend a second year without Easter holidays, without potentially being able to travel outside of the country. for summer. And I think this is playing in European governments.
The European Commission, the EU's executive arm tasked for procuring the vaccines, has borne the brunt of criticism over production shortfalls and other problems. Chief Ursula von der Leyen acknowledged mistakes, but she recently told a German newspaper the 27-member bloc is now catching up to Britain. And analyst Mortera Martinez believes most EU leaders will close ranks in a public show of support for the Commission. They're also expected to discuss international efforts to supply vaccines to developing countries, along with so-called vaccination certificates to ensure safe travel, but which are controversial. So, are border restrictions by some EU states aimed to slow the virus's spread? The Commission has asked for those to be lifted, arguing they risk disrupting free movement and trade. Reports indicate the controls will stay put for now, but analyst Mortera Martinez says the open border principle is central for the bloc.
I think there's much more than, you know, the immediate vaccination politics that is about the survival of the European project once again, as it seems to have been, you know, like for every single crisis in the past 10 years.
On Friday, European leaders will turn to security and defense issues. During last week's security conference in Munich, U.S. President Joe Biden sought to reassure Europe of America's commitment to NATO and its allies after ties were frayed under the Trump administration. But a new survey suggests many Europeans are skeptical. Polling citizens from 10 EU member states, it found just 10% considered the U.S. a reliable defense partner, while two-thirds supported investing instead in Europe's own defense capabilities. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A German court has sentenced to prison a former member of the security services of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad for abetting the torture of civilians. It's the first verdict for crimes against humanity in the 10-year-old civil war, Saraya Ali of Reuters reports.
A German court sentenced a former member of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad's security services to prison on Wednesday for abetting the torture of civilians. In the first verdict of crimes against humanity in the 10-year-old civil war. The higher regional court sentenced Iyad A to 4.5 years in prison, saying he had arrested at least 30 anti-government protesters at the start of the conflict in 2011 and sent them to an intelligence facility where he knew detainees were tortured. Wasim Mukhtad was a plaintiff and witness in the trial.
This is the first step. The road to justice is long. And one of the goals is to bring Bashar al-Assad and his inner circle before a court. This is a relief, but it's also not the end. It's only the beginning.
The Assad government denies it tortures prisoners, but the verdict gives hope to the 800,000 Syrians in Germany who say they were tortured in government facilities. Prosecutors secured the trial under Germany's universal jurisdiction laws, which allows courts to prosecute crimes against humanity committed anywhere in the world. The same court will continue hearings in another case of a former intelligence officer charged with 58 murders in a Damascus prison, where prosecutors say at least 4,000 opposition activists were tortured in 2011 and 2012.
That was Saraya Ali of Reuters. The children of many displaced families in Syria are often doing dangerous, low-paid work as a means to survive, because their families are neglected by governments and aid organizations. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report with journalists Mohammed Daboul and Fatah Rasulan in Idlib, Syria.
Children pick through a field of trash not far from the tents in which they live. They make less than a dollar a day selling the recyclable items, which is barely enough to buy food. At 12 years old, Hassan Alhamdi says he works every day from morning until night at the dump. He seems proud to provide food for his family, but his seven siblings also have to work. His mother, Mahdia Alhamdi, says it is heartbreaking to see her children grow up without education. But in this isolated area, no humanitarian aid is available. Impoverished makeshift settlements like this one are scattered across Idlib, the last remaining stronghold of the Syrian opposition, where nearly 1 million people fled their homes around the beginning of last year. Since then, the people have been trapped between warring parties as the coronavirus pandemic has ravaged the region's economy. Non-government organizations have set up some schools in this area, but administrators say that many children who do attend increasingly come in late or leave early for their jobs. Mazen Nayaz, a school manager, says child labor also drives up adult unemployment, making the region even poorer. UNICEF says around the world, it is likely that millions more children are now being pushed into the workforce because of the pandemic. And the longer children are out of school, the organization says, the less likely they are to have the chance to return. Human Rights Watch says 2 million displaced Syrian children are currently out of school. And for many, like 11-year-old Ali Alhamdi, who works at the dump with his brother Hassan, returning seems like a faraway dream. Ali says ultimately he wishes for a bicycle, a football, and to go back to school. But for now, he says, he is just tired from work. Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
This is VOA. The top United Nations chief for humanitarian affairs is warning that Yemen, quote, is falling off a cliff, end quote, and will face the worst famine the world has seen for decades unless donors contribute generously to this year's $3.85 billion UN humanitarian appeal. Mark Locock said Wednesday that Gulf countries, especially Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, cut donations drastically last year. That forced aid agencies to provide help to just 9 million Yemenis per month last year, down from over 13 million in 2019. He said the 4 million people who didn't receive food last year are among those in the, quote, agonizing process of starving to death, end quote. The International Olympic Committee said Wednesday that the refugee team that will compete at the Tokyo Olympics will be finalized in June from a group of 55 athletes preparing to participate in 12 sports. The IOC unveiled its first team of refugees at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016. That 10-member team included athletes from Syria, Congo, Ethiopia, and South Sudan, and competed in athletics, swimming, and judo. The IOC has said the refugee team in Tokyo will be larger than the one in Rio. And a U.S. Inspector General's Office report set to be released today faulted weaknesses in the country's certification of the Boeing 737 MAX airplane. Two 737 MAX jets crashed in Indonesia in 2018 and Ethiopia in 2019, killing a total of 346 people. The new U.S. Transportation Department's Inspector General report was seen by Reuters. It said the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration did not have a complete understanding of a key Boeing safety system tied to both crashes. It said much work remains to address outstanding issues and cited, quote, management and oversight weaknesses, end quote. The FAA agreed to implement the report's 14 recommendations. Boeing declined to immediately comment.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's newest Mars rover, Perseverance, recently touched down on the red planet and already is amazing scientists and lay people alike. The space agency has released breathtaking high-definition video of the robotic explorer plummeting through the thin Martian atmosphere and, with the help of its parachute and sky crane, was gently lowered to the surface of Mars. According to NASA, the rover not only contains a suite of state-of-the-art exploratory instruments, but also contains two microphones to capture the sounds of Mars. 2 days after landing, the space agency activated those microphones for a few moments. What you're hearing are the sounds of Martian breezes, with the rover's mechanical noise filtered out. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. A UN human rights expert is calling for an urgent investigation into allegations that Eritrean forces have forcibly repatriated Eritrean refugees who were living in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province. His report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdel Salam Babiker, started his mandate on November 1st. An Ethiopian military offensive began in Tigray November 4th, after months of rising tensions between Addis Ababa and forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. When the conflict erupted, he says more than 96,000 Eritrean refugees were in four camps. Addressing the Human Rights Council on Wednesday, Babaker said he has received information from credible sources about the precarious situation of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the province. Babaker added,
I'm also concerned about the allegations of possible implication of the Eritrean troops in cases of serious human rights violations, including acts of abductions, forceful or involuntary return of Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers, and their imprisonment in different prisons inside Eritrea. Such allegations need to be investigated promptly and thoroughly by independent mechanisms.
There was no response from the Ethiopian or Eritrean governments. Babaker said he is particularly concerned about two refugee camps in Tigray that hosted more than 25,000 Eritreans. These, he said, allegedly were destroyed in attacks by Eritrean and Ethiopian troops, acts which would constitute a serious breach of international humanitarian law.
On 28th of January 2021, in my letter to the government of Ethiopia, I called on the Ethiopian authorities to protect the human rights of the Eritrean refugees and asylum seekers in the Tigray region, and to ensure respect for their rights under human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international refugee law.
Babaker said he wants Eritrean authorities to give him full access to refugees and asylum seekers allegedly in Eritrean prisons. Babaker also said he has received no response to previous requests from the Eritrean authorities to visit Eritrea to assess the human rights situation on the ground. Eritrean Ambassador at Large Tesfamikel Geratu dismissed the Special Rapporteur's report as being full of senseless allegations and of presenting a bleak, unjustified picture of his country. He said his government has succeeded in creating meaningful, sustainable development based on social justice. He added it was time for the Council to end its harassment of Eritrea and terminate its mandate on the human rights situation in the country, which has been going on for 8 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next door to Eritrea, Sudan has ratified UN conventions against torture and enforced disappearances after approval by the country's governing body, opposition parties, and rebel groups. Rights groups and activists who suffered under the rule of former President Omar al-Bashir have welcomed the decision. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum, Sudan.
On Tuesday, Sudan's Sovereign Council ratified UN conventions against torture and enforced disappearances after months of delay. At a press conference, Minister of Justice Nasreddin Abdulbari confirmed Sudan's ratification of the conventions and described the step as huge and important. Abdulbari says the two councils have discussed the 2006 UN conventions for the protection of all persons from enforced disappearances and 1984 convention against torture and inhuman punishment. The two councils have ratified to join the two conventions. This step is historical due to the massive issues Sudanese have suffered out of torture, which was common in the past regime, and the cases of enforced disappearances. Sudan's second most important political body, the Ministers' Council, approved the two conventions last November. The Sovereign Council waited, a delay that rights groups attribute to the likely involvement of the military's rapid support forces in some abuses, specifically the kidnapping and torture of 45-year-old Bahanuri in December. Imad Hamdoun was a victim of both torture and enforced disappearance during the iron-fisted rule of Omar al-Bashir. In 2019, he was arrested, tortured, and lost the sight in one eye. He says ratifying these laws is a victory for them, as rights defenders and victims of June 30 regime. He hopes that the government signs the two conventions to the UN General Secretary as soonest, so the Sudanese people are able to have these privileges they have been deprived of in the past years of the former regime. Rights groups have also welcomed the step and are calling on the government to set many procedures to validate the pacts. This is Winnie Umar, the spokesperson of Protect the Right to Life campaign, a movement of lawyers, rights activists, and the families of torture and disappearance victims. She says they welcome the step made by the transitional government. She thinks this step should be followed by a group of procedures and set ground rules for these rights, like monitoring and lifting immunity and many other procedures to guarantee the validity of the conventions on reality. On a related issue, the Sudanese Supreme Court has upheld death sentences for 29 security officers convicted of kidnapping, torturing, and killing a teacher during the uprisings that toppled Bashir in 2019. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Amnesty International has revoked its prisoner of conscience status previously given to Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Adam Reed of Reuters reports.
Amnesty International, the human rights NGO, says that it no longer considers jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny a prisoner of conscience due to past comments he made that it believes qualify as advocacy of hate. In a statement sent to Reuters, Amnesty said some of these comments, which Navalny has not publicly denounced, reached the threshold of advocacy of hatred. And this is at odds with Amnesty's definition of a prisoner of conscience. Amnesty did not say what comments it was specifically referring to. But in the past, Navalny has been criticized for nationalist statements against illegal immigration and for attending an annual nationalist march several years ago. In a 2007 video, he called for the deportation of migrants to prevent the rise of far-right violence, saying, "We have the right to be Russians in Russia and we'll defend that right." However, Amnesty did go on record to say Navalny should be released from jail and that he has committed no crime. It says he's being persecuted for his campaigning and outspoken criticism of President Vladimir Putin. He was arrested on his return to Russia last month following a near-fatal poisoning last year. Navalny is set to spend just over 2.5 years in jail for parole violations he called trumped up. His allies protested the move by Amnesty on Twitter. They included Ivan Zandov, who said, quote, "The procedure for assigning and revoking Amnesty International status has proven extremely shameful."
That was Reuters' Adam Reed. A former New York City police officer has been charged with using an aluminum pole to attack a U.S. Capitol officer during the January 6th assault on the Capitol building by supporters of former President Donald Trump. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
A former New York City police officer has been charged with assaulting a U.S. Capitol officer when supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building earlier this year. 54-year-old Thomas Webster, also a former Marine, surrendered to authorities in New York on Monday after the FBI sought the public's help to find him. A federal prosecutor said the married father of three was captured on video attacking a Capitol police officer with a pole and his bare hands, ripping off the officer's protective gear and shouting obscenities. Webster's lawyer said he had only been at the Capitol on January 6th to protest. But the federal judge in his case said, quote, "What we see in the video goes well beyond First Amendment speech and moves into criminal activity." The federal prosecutor said in response to the footage, quote, "These videos shocked the conscience, a look of pure rage on the defendant's face. His teeth were gritted." More than 200 people have been charged for their roles in the Capitol riot, which left five people dead.
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. Our last story today, Kenya is battling some of the worst locust plagues in decades. But a new startup called The Bug Picture hopes to transform the pests into profits. Francesca Lanag of Reuters reports.
Kenya is battling some of the worst locust plagues in decades. They've been devouring crops and other vegetation, ruining livelihoods of local farmers. But one startup called The Bug Pitcher is working to bring hope by harvesting the locusts and turning them into animal feed and organic fertilizer. Yeah. The idea sounds simple enough. The locusts are first harvested, then crushed, dried, and milled into powder, which is then turned into protein-rich animal feed. The insects are collected at night by torchlight when they are resting on shrubs and trees. Harvesting during the day is out of the question. Albert Lemasulani is a field coordinator working for the Bug Pitcher.
Biological behavior of locusts is that they start roosting in the evening from 6:30 and up to 8 in the following day, 8, 9. So where we normally like to have them try to start harvesting as early as 5:30 because they are sleeping, they are weak, they can't move, they can just be picked or they can shake the trees and collect. It's easier for them to collect. You can't collect locusts during the midday because they keep on flying.
Abdi Apchagai is programs officer at NGO Sapcone.
We are doing the crushing of the locusts after collecting them from the community, local communities last night. And after crushing them, now they'll be dried. After drying now, they'll be taken for milling. Milling now is when now it will be processed into powder and now it will be packed. Then the formulation now starts from there, where the locust powder is being added other components to form animal feed and organic fertilizer for farms.
Swarms of between 40 and 80 million locusts per square kilometre can travel up to 93 miles per day. But the insects are also protein-rich, which makes them ideal for animal feed.
Locusts apparently have like 70% of protein, so it substitutes the biggest protein. The most expensive part of animal feed is the protein.
The Bug Project partners with local farmers to harvest the locusts. Locals receive 50 shillings or 46 US cents for every £2 collected. Between February 1st and February 18th, 2021, the project oversaw the harvest of 1.3 tons of locusts. Another way of controlling them is spraying locusts with pesticides before they can fly. But the chemicals can damage other insects and the environment. The Bug Pitcher is targeting swarms of 5 hectares or less in inhabited areas not suitable for spraying. But while the project offers a more sustainable approach to help farmers fight back against the locusts, the root of the problem is climate change. Scientists say warmer seas are creating more rain, waking dormant eggs. Cyclones that disperse the swarms are also getting stronger and more frequent.
That was Francesca Lanag of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Former Ugandan Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, Commander Dominic Ongwen has been convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. Ongwen, the first member of the LRA to appear before the court, was convicted on 61 of the 70 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes he faced. The charges relate to attacks on 4 camps for internally displaced people in Uganda in 2003 and 2004. He was convicted of several war crimes and crimes against humanity, including murder, torture, enslavement, conscripting children under 15, persecution, forced marriage, rape, and forced pregnancy. This is the first conviction for forced pregnancy by any international criminal tribunal. Ongwen, whose sentence is to be handed down at a later date, could face life imprisonment. The United States welcomes the conviction of Ongwen for war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is a significant step for justice and accountability for atrocities committed by the LRA, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. We hope that this verdict brings some measure of peace to the many victims. The United States helped facilitate the voluntary surrender and transfer of Ongwen to the ICC in 2015. While we continue to believe the ICC is in need of significant reform, said spokesperson Price, we are pleased to see Ongwen brought to justice. We hope Ongwen's conviction demonstrates to the people of Uganda that the perpetrators of the crimes committed against them will be held accountable. There will be justice, and the horrible legacy of the LRA's tactics to perpetuate and prolong violence and abuse will be addressed, spokesperson Price added. The United States continues to offer a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the arrest, transfer, or conviction of Joseph Kony, leader of the Lord's Resistance Army. Anyone with information about him or his whereabouts can email wcrp@state.gov or send a WhatsApp text message to 1-202-975-5468.